Hi again, welcome back. Glad you were here. All of you folks around the United States listening on all of our affiliate stations, a special welcome. It is May 1st. We've made it this far. And to all of you listening around the world on the Internet, hi. And to those of you who will be listening to the archive programs at some point in the future, welcome indeed. And remember, all of our programs are archived for your listening convenience, going all the way back to 1997. There are a lot of programs with an incredible amount of material, really and truly a portrait of our times in many respects. One of the legendary scholars, truly, in the field of conspiracy research, or what many refer to as reality, is Eustace Mullins. Maybe his most popular book of many of his works is Murder by Injection. It is talked about, it is read all the time, every day. He is a remarkable man with a great history and an even more remarkable view and perception of our world and our nation. And he is my guest for the first part of tonight's program. And it's about time. Welcome to the program, Eustace.
Well, I'm so glad to be with you.
It's my pleasure indeed. And as I mentioned, it's for years I've wanted to get Eustace Mullins on the program, but I just don't know. I guess it was one of those things that tonight's the night.
It certainly is.
All right. Now, as you look back on your career, which is a really wonderful walk through our life and our times, did you expect the disintegration of this country, the slide toward totalitarian fascism, to be this far along this quickly?
No, I did not. In 1945, of course, I served through World War II in the Air Force, but as you know, in 1945, we were preeminent, and it was awfully hard to believe that we were going to come to where we are now.
I'm sure, and I try to make that point. And for those of you folks who are certainly younger than Mr. Mullins and others who did live through World War II or even the 1950s, look at the old movies, look at the old newspapers, and read and get a sense of the values, of the perceptions, of the fiber of what America was. It is gone. I mean, it is still there. In the hinterlands, and I think when you take any citizen of any country one-on-one, you'll find some very good common sense and rudimentary values. But, Eustace, I don't know what word to ascribe to your feelings about what's happened to this country. I'll leave that up to you and ask you, how would you describe your feelings about what has become of the America you fought for in World War II?
Well, the American youth has been so brainwashed and destroyed. That's what I'm worried about.
they're gone.
They're gone, yes.
Not all of them, but most of them.
Most of them, yes.
I've spent years and years talking about this on the program. And coupled with that, that triumph of advertising and the creation of consumer units, the destruction of our education system, and you have young people who really don't have a chance. And as I've said many times, how do you wake someone up when there's no one inside to awaken?
Yes, and they're the ones who are being robbed. For instance, anyone who goes to an American college today is absolutely being robbed. They're getting nothing, and they charge them $30,000 a year.
They're getting nothing all the way up the educational ladder. You're right. Well, education is big business, and unfortunately the business is not one of educating. You have watched the diminution of the intellect of our average high school graduate over the years, as have I. Something like 70% are functional or nearly functionally illiterate now. If you were king, Eustace Mullins, what would you do?
Oh, I think I would declare a school holiday, and when they open the next Monday, everybody would get to work.
I like that. All right, I like that. Sounds like something Will Rogers might say.
Well, it's like bank holiday that Roosevelt did, you know. We had a bank holiday, and then the banks reopened.
Yeah, since you've opened the bank vault here, let's talk about your prodigious knowledge. And you were really the first man to, I think, do the Paul Revere about the Federal Reserve, at least in my recollection. The Fed, of course, called by many people the biggest outrage, the biggest theft of the century, of last... How's that? Last century already. Well, all right.
Yeah, last century, but we're still suffering. Well, I call it the Federal Robbery System, and I call the Internal Revenue Service the Internal Robbery System.
I like that. Sure.
Yeah, I went right into tax court and beat them, you know, as my own lawyer. I don't think the judge ever got over that.
Tell us a little bit about that. And people don't know. You've got a great audience tonight, so go ahead and tell us how Eustace Mullins went in and beat the robber barons in court.
Well, first, I got a notice from the mail from the local IRS auditor to bring in all my books and papers. And I read this over, and I thought, well, this is a rather frightening thing. And then I realized, well, if I was frightened, then I ought to do something about it. So I sued the agent for $350,000 for terrorism.
Oh.
No one's ever done that before or since. And the IRS was astounded. They had no idea what to do, so they put out the cousin of the director here was a friend of mine, and we had dinner, and she said, I said, what is your cousin saying? And she said, oh, he says, everyone knows Eustace Mullins is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's their response, you know. That's the only response they had.
Right, right.
So I had a lot of fun with them for about 9 months, and finally the federal court dismissed it, and then they immediately sent me a notice of tax delinquency because they had disallowed, you know, everything I'd sent in. And so that's when I went into tax court. But I sent the U.S. Tax Court stipulations before we had our hearing,
mm-hmm.
and I said, you see, the FBI and the IRS had both conspired to put me in a mental institution in 1959, and I didn't know it until 1981 when I got my FBI file. So it was 60 pages of memoranda signed by J. Edgar Hoover about committing me to a mental institution. And, of course, at that time, everyone in Washington knew that J. Edgar Hoover was in dire need of a psychiatrist himself.
Himself, yeah.
In fact, they were talking about it on the news, that Washington News, that he was insane. So anyway, I sent them these stipulations, and then when we had the hearing before the tax court, I chose Richmond, Virginia. You could choose wherever you wanted, and
huh.
I went to Richmond, and I was so excited because I was going to have my day in court, and I was going to meet these lawyers from the IRS that I'd been corresponding with for about 8 months.
Uh-huh.
And so I walk into court, and there's no one there. The IRS would not send anyone in to face me. And that is so astounding, I still can't believe it myself.
No show.
Well. So the judge said, I want you to talk to this U.S. attorney and work this out. And a young U.S. attorney was there.
Uh-huh.
So we went in, and he agreed with me that everything I'd put in was okay. We came out, and the judge said, have you gentlemen reached a decision? We said, yes. And the judge gave me a letter that I had no tax delinquency.
And I what was a on, wonderful story.
I was on a lecture in California with three guys
uh-huh.
who had also won, and they didn't win in tax court. They went before a jury in court,
mm-hmm.
and the jury decided in their favor, but they had lawyers. They spent mm-hmm. $35,000 to $50,000 apiece.
Yeah.
And I hadn't spent a dime. So after they gave their lectures and told how they had won because their lawyers, and I got up and I said, well, I don't want the people to lose heart because these gentlemen did a great job and they won their cases. But
mm-hmm.
I said, I have to tell you, I went into tax court without a lawyer and I won also.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were offended and they never invited me back.
Is that right?
Yeah. I haven't been before that group again since 5 years.
Very unfortunate, the pettiness of some people. When the whole issue is one of fear, of course, and intimidation, that's how the game is played.
And that's why we want to work together. It's so hard to get people to work with you because their egos get in the way.
Egos, and they have their own little clique, their own disciples, their own little turf. And
they really do.
You're right. It's a very myopic world, many of them inhabit. This is a very fascinating thing. In the early 80s, you got your FBI file, you read through it, and I just have to ask you how you felt when you came across 60 pages of memoranda signed by Hoover trying to, in collusion with the IRS, put you in a loony bin.
Oh, yeah. Well, I tell you, it was astounding. And I was shocked because I had known nothing about it. And they'd actually come to my apartment in Chicago, the FBI, to pick me up and take me before a Cook County judge. You know, 69 of them went to prison later on
uh-huh.
in a sting operation.
Right.
And once I went behind the walls, I probably would still be there.
Oh, sure. No, they're not going to let you loose. Far too dangerous.
But I had gone to Michigan to write Ezra Pound's biography at Lake Mecosta, Michigan, and no one knew where I was because, you know, I never told anybody anything. And the FBI, you know, Jed Gahoo put out a national alert for me at every bus station, airline, and railroad station in the United States.
For Eustace Mullins?
Well, he thought
an all points national bulletin to pick you up.
Absolutely, because he thought I was coming to Washington to kill him. Because well, he figured that's what he would do in my circumstances, and so he thought that's what I would do.
Well, he wasn't completely stupid, was he? It's that is, there is some logic there. I mean, you try and destroy a man's life, and you get a little worried.
Oh, you do.
All right, stand by. We'll be right back with the extraordinary Eustace Mullins in just a couple of minutes. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along. Stay right there.
If you're enjoying this broadcast of the Jeff Rentz program, you might want to share it with a friend, a family member, or civic leader. Cassette copies of this Jeff Rentz program can be yours by calling 1-888-836-4670. For just $12 plus $3 shipping, you'll receive original high-quality cassette recordings of this broadcast. These programs come from the original broadcast master and are preserved on high-quality cassette tapes. With your Visa or MasterCard, you can have your own copy within 2 weeks, yours to enjoy for years to come. Call 1-888-836-4670 or order by mail by sending a check or money order to Watkins Audio, Post Office Box 5543, Central Point, Oregon 97502, or call 1-888-836-4670. That's 1-888-836-4670. 4670.
Eustace Mullins will be making a keynote address at a very important conference in California. It's a conspiracy conference. And those of you who have been with the program for any length of time at all realize full well now that the world is run by conspiracy. Anyone who says you are a conspiracy nut or whatever is so hopelessly lost that you don't want to spend too much time with that mentality. Eustace, tell me about the conference coming up, will you please?
Oh, well, Ted Gunderson's going to be there. I appear at a lot of meetings. He was head of the L.A. station for years, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And Ted will be there, and I'll
FBI,
be speaking.
I think he was 15, 16 years or something in L.A., a long time, 30,
oh,
35 years
time.
In the FBI and all that, yeah.
Oh, yeah, well, Ted knows, he knows everything that goes on, you know. He's very good. And I'm speaking on Sunday. Bo Greitz will be there, Tony Hilder. Well, in fact, I know just about everybody that's going to be there.
The actual dates of the conference?
It's May 25th, 26th at the Santa Clara Marriott at Santa Clara.
And do we have a contact phone number for tickets or anything else? I can get it if you don't.
209-832-0999.
Okay, this is a big deal. This is, again, in Santa Clara at the Marriott. May 25 and 26, for all of you people in California or who are going to be in the Santa Clara area, mark that on your calendars. May 25th, 26th, coming up the end of this month, 209-832-0999 for ticket information. I've got to go back to the J. Edgar Hoover issue. He was almost he was an autocrat. He was a mini despot is what he was for a long time. How he could railroad someone into a mental hospital will confuse people. But you've got to remember, folks, this happened how many years ago now? 40?
59.
What, 40 years ago? 42
oh, yeah.
years ago.
Yeah.
The tricks back then, of course, were a little more straightforward. Now, to destroy a reputation, it probably takes one phone call, given the control of the American media and everything else.
Well, the reason that J. Edgar thought I was going to shoot him was that he thought I'd been tipped off. See, I had a good friend who was head of the photo lab at the FBI, and I lived in his home for 7 or 8 years. And so he thought he must have tipped me off, and that's why he was scared.
Well, what would you have been tipped off about that he was particularly concerned over?
That he was going to put me in a mental institution.
Okay. Now, the memoranda that you got in the FBI file? Just a thumbnail sketch, if you will. What were the grounds? What were the mechanics that were going to be used and all that?
Two FBI agents were to come to my apartment in Chicago. I lived a block and a half from the scene of the St. Valentine Massacre.
Uh-huh.
And I lived a block and a half from the Biograph Theater, where J. Dillinger was assassinated by the FBI.
That's enough to make anybody crazy, right?
Well, yes.
Jeez. All right.
And they thought the agents would come and take me before a judge, and the judge would commit me. Very simple.
On what grounds, though? On how were you to be adjudged less than competent mentally?
Well, there was no complaints on me about anything, but they were just going to come and take me before the judge, and they would say I was incompetent, and
uh-huh.
the judge would agree.
Okay, it was just as they say nowadays, it was a slam dunk.
Well, it was a slam dunk because I would be saying, I'm not crazy, which, of course, crazy people always do. So that would prove that I was.
I've heard that.
That's absolutely true.
That's funny. And then you would have mentioned the Biograph Theater, and do you remember the judge, the St. Valentine? Yeah, never mind.
Well, see, that's all paranoia, and that's
sure.
All they need is paranoia, and you're gone.
Wow.
You know, I've said for years in my lectures that my definition of paranoia is a paranoid person is an American who hasn't been murdered yet.
Now, that has a certain ring to it. I like that. By the way, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, something that most younger listeners, and we have a lot of them, don't know much about. That was one of the classic moments in the gangster era of America.
Yeah, it really was, because it was so cold-blooded, and these guys met in a garage, and then some people dressed in police uniforms came in and shot them in the back, and that was it.
You know, I shouldn't say the gangster era in America as past tense. It's just changed a little.
Well, you know, it was invented by Colonel McCormick, a staunch conservative who owned the Chicago Tribune. The reason the gangsters got powerful in Chicago was the circulation wars. And the Tribune and the Daily News were fighting each other, and they hired a lot of gangsters and thugs to beat up the delivery people and to trash their papers.
I didn't know that.
Oh,
so
yeah.
they were really threatening newspaper vendors on the corner and the whole thing.
Oh, they even killed some of them. They beat them up and put a bomb in their newsstand and so forth. And no, this was before Prohibition, you see.
Ah.
And so because of the circulation wars, the gangsters had gotten so much experience, you know, from killing and so forth, that when the Prohibition came along, they were ready for the big time.
How interesting. I didn't know that.
To good old Colonel McCormick.
That's fascinating. He doesn't even have a Sicilian ring to his name, does he?
No. Well, he was just a millionaire that hired people to work for him.
That's
so.
Amazing. Amazing story. Well, those days, those times, the stuff of myth nowadays and Hollywood legend. Speaking of Hollywood, we're going to a break in just a moment or two, but I'd like you to comment when we come back about the basic concept that Hollywood, for better or for worse, and capital W on the worse, has created much, if not most, of common and conversational American history through the movies. The control over this country by Hollywood and the film industry is enormous. Did you see that coming as a young man, by the way, when you'd go to theaters and see these dramatizations and realize the impact they were having on the masses?
Not at all. When I was a child, my father would take me to the movies, and we saw a serial called The Indians Are Coming, and it was very primitive, of course, in the early 20s, mm-hmm. and it was about the Indians attacking the settlers. That was all the history that I got.
Wow. All right. Stand by. We'll take our break and come right back with Eustace Mullins in just a couple minutes. Okay, we're right back with Eustace Mullins, enjoying a wonderful look back at some of the, just a couple of the amazing things that have happened to him. And he says, not everybody that can claim that J. Edgar Hoover was obsessed enough with them to have tried to put them in a loony bin. That's remarkable. What happened in 81, I think it was, when you got the FBI file? Did you consider taking them to court and suing them for terrorism? That would terrorize me if I saw 60 pages of memoranda signed by the man himself.
Well, what I did sue them and for a violation of my rights and so forth. And I sued them for $50 million, and they wouldn't answer, so they let it default. And I didn't know it at that time, but that's the standard government thing on a suit like that. They won't answer. They let you go into default and then figure out you can't do anything about it. So I do my own legal work, and so I entered the default judgment with the federal court. It's still on the books.
Wow. How do we collect, Eustace?
Oh, I can collect any time. I was going to take the White House and then charge the President writ on it, because I could do that. And I was going to get the Library of Congress, too, because that was my favorite place. I used to live there at one time.
I think you ought to.
Yeah, I moved in and stayed 6 months one time, because it was a wonderful place at night. It was totally quiet and deserted. It was the safest place in Washington.
Where did you sleep?
There was a little music room down in the base, an auditorium. It was the Coolidge Auditorium.
Uh-huh.
And I was related to the Coolidges very distantly. And so I had gone to concerts there, and I prowled around, and I found out there was this nice dressing room back in the back with a bed and a bath and so on, a toilet and so forth. And so I was working at the library every day doing my research from 9 in the morning to 9 at night, and they closed. And so I realized one day I could just go ahead and go back in there and stay, and no one would ever bother me. And that's why I stayed there for 6 months.
That's nice. Is that little room still there?
Oh, yes. The auditorium it's the Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge Auditorium on the ground floor.
They got the Lincoln bedroom in the White House, and I had the
Mullins auditorium.
Yeah, right there in the auditorium.
I guess it'll be a shrine someday.
I think we should at least put a plaque on the door.
Well,
Eustace slept here.
Yeah.
6 months.
6 months.
And that's another wonderful little piece of history.
But I only did it to save rent. I wasn't thinking of making it a historic place.
Here's a man with a $50 million default judgment against the United States government, for what it's worth.
No, I got a second one. I sued them a second time for $35 million. And again, they defaulted, and so I put that in the federal court records, too. You see, with the default judgment, you go right to the clerk of the court. You don't go through a judge. So I filed my default judgment with the clerk of the court. They're both on the records. I refile them every year with the IRS. I file income tax every year, but I have claims for over $130 million against the government, and I have to keep them alive. I file every year. People always ask me, Eustace, do you file? I say, certainly. Do you think I want to lose my money?
Oh, that's amazing. With interest and penalties?
Interest and penalties. So really, I'm set for life.
You're set for several lives.
Yes, I think so.
All right, let's come fast forward to this talk about craziness and loony bins, this world of these greed-mongering, ravenous, evil power brokers who are, of course, treating us like nothing more than digits in a computer. Let's go first to the Middle East, just because it's been top of the news for weeks now. Give us Eustace Mullins' observations. What's going on there? What's going to happen in your best estimation?
Well, right now, I think Washington is trying to figure out a way to dump Israel, because they've gotten to be too dangerous for them, you know. See, they were using the Israelis for years. The whole idea of setting up the State of Israel was so they could raise oil prices. And
okay.
They've used the Israelis all along, and the Israelis have no idea of this. They think that they're fulfilling God's commandment, you know, by settling there.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who settled there are Khazars, as Arthur Koestler pointed out in his book, The 13th Tribe. They have no relationship whatsoever to the ancient Hebrews or to God either.
So who are the Semitic peoples?
The Semitic peoples are actually us. We Americans. This is the new Israel here. And this was the, by the way, this was the religious faith of the United States for our first 100 years. We knew we were the people of the New Israel. Samuel Adams said, we have come to this continent to set up the New Israel. Hmm. That was the slogan of the Revolution. But you don't find that in the history books anymore. It was totally deleted after 1900.
Talk about revisionism.
Oh, that was revisionism.
Yeah. So this whole thing is even more predicated on oil than most anyone who's not familiar with your works and maybe the works of a few others realizes. It has nothing to do with what we're commonly thought or taught to believe.
No, and the only columnist who's pointed this out is Chris Matthews. He had a column a couple of weeks ago in which he said this was the oil business, you know. And as far as I know, no one else has the nerve to say that but him.
Well, in your estimation, Eustace, is Israel running amok now, out of the control of
that? That is the problem, you see. They've become dangerous. They're like a mad dog, and these people are going to dump them because, you know, they can't take that.
When you say mad dog, I think we have to elaborate on that a little bit. Israel, it's not that this is a small country. This is a country with the fourth or fifth largest nuclear arsenal on the planet. This is a country that has received from the United States taxpayers how much money, Eustace, in the last quarter century?
It runs about $20 billion a year.
That's the total
years.
Aggregate. Total.
Yeah.
The total aggregate is that high. I've
yes,
heard six,
is.
But it is higher.
No, it's a, see, six is the cash that we give them every year, but the military aid is even bigger than that. The military aid is about $8 billion a year. You see, it's all listed. It's an accounting thing. It's listed under so many different entries.
You know where to look, you find it. Figure, even if Eustace Mullins is half off, let's say it's $10 billion a year, just for conversation's sake, and multiply that by 25 years, that's a lot of money. If he's right at $20 billion, that's 25 times 20. That's approaching half a trillion. Lots to think about. We'll be right back. Back into it with Eustace Mullins. By the way, the Conspiracy Conference, the 25th and 26th in Santa Clara, can be accessed over the net at conspiracycon.com. Conspiracycon.com. It's all there. And this is going to be a great roundtable of brilliant people and a remarkable insight into how this country of ours and the world is really being manipulated. So back to the Israeli issue, which continues to incite major emotion, of course, amongst people who have been attentive to the mainstream media for a long time. Did I phrase that right?
Oh, yes, I think you did. Well, you know, it all started with Harry Truman. The reason that Truman beat Dewey was that Truman promised them he would recognize Israel if he was reelected. And that's why they had the last-minute television blitz. It was one of the first television blitzes, and they raised money and put Truman in.
That did it, huh?
That's why Dewey and the Republicans thought they had it won. They didn't know what was going on behind the scenes.
They didn't recognize, apparently, the power of television, not to mention the backstage manipulations.
Oh, absolutely. It was the backstage manipulations. Leon Cronheim, who is a liquor dealer in Washington, put up the money for Truman at the last minute, and that's what carried him through. And then Truman made his son a judge. Judge Cronheim, his son, became one of the top judges in D.C.
Well, it is said that Truman made his own daughter a singer, too, so what...
Well, there you are. No, that thing started with Truman, and when the other politicians realized what the Israelis could do for them, they jumped on board.
Interesting. So that was the genesis of the amazing power, which has only accrued and compounded probably exponentially in the last 54, 55 years since the 48 election.
Well, it has, because it gave them everything. You had the money, and you had the media coverage. Mm-hmm. I mean, where else you would get a deal like that?
And before I go any further, I want to put this on the table, and it has. I've received a few emails. I would say the emails here in our Rents.com website inbox are running hundreds to one in favor of the broad-brushed approach I try to utilize in bringing as much news as I can from the various world media to all of the people out there listening. There are a few, of course, that throw the old hackneyed cliche of anti-Semite, which is, I think, finally at long last, beginning to run out of steam, Eustace. It has petered out,
but you know, it worked against me for years. When they heard I was going to be on a show or going to make a speech anywhere, they turned out their big guns, and lots of times they succeeded. But it didn't bother me because I realized what was going on, and I think the tide has turned now.
I've tried to impress upon people that criticizing a government, such as the current government of Israel, does not make someone anti-Semitic nor anti-Jewish. There are millions of Jews who oppose the current policies of the Sharon regime, if you can use that word, and some do. They are appalled. There are refuseniks over there who are not willing to serve and all the rest of it. Whether they're active duty or reserves, it doesn't matter. So this, I think the whole thing is changing. There is a waking up going on, which is very healthy for everyone, I think, Jew and non-Jew alike. This 50-year paradigm of throwing the anti-Semitic label at people and making it stick in far too many cases, I think has pretty well run its course, and it's time.
But I was one of the first victims. You know, I was on the staff of the Library of Congress, and I was fired in 1952 at the personal order of Senator Herbert Lehman, who was at that time not only senator from New York, but was also national chairman of the ADL.
And combination.
And I'm the only person that's ever been fired from the Library of Congress for political reasons.
National chairman of the ADL and a U.S. senator.
And head of Lehman Brothers Banker also. You know, his daughter was Alger Hiss's lawyer, Helen Lehman Buttonweiser.
I didn't know that either.
Well,
It's all in the family, isn't it?
It's all in the family. It's a little crowd of people. You know, my work has gotten so much easier over the last 30 years because I was dealing with the same names all the time, and I already knew all about them, so it's just been a piece of cake.
That's funny. When one looks at the number of people in the current administration who are Jewish, some are Israeli-connected and so forth, and then one factors in the exposition of what is called the largest spy ring ever discovered in America, that being the Israeli Mossad spy ring in this country, one has to ask legitimate questions, honest questions, about how much power, how much control over America, over the Congress, over the Senate, and over the administration that the Israeli interests now wield. Do you have any way to quantify that?
They wield a lot. I just saw Richard Perle, who's one of the leaders. He was on O'Reilly's show just a few minutes ago, and Richard Perle is one of the top five people in this country. I just wrote a very explosive article on the Israeli fifth column in this country.
Which of course, you mentioned the money we have given to Israel. They certainly use our money to subsidize their espionage here in America.
Well, they also use it to buy back our congressmen. The congressmen vote the money for Israel, and a good chunk of that comes back to and donations to them.
Isn't that funny?
So they're using our own money to buy our congressmen more money. They can give our congressmen more money than you and I could ever give.
Well, no one can say they're stupid.
No, they certainly are not. Well, they understand the playing field and they know how to run the show. But interestingly enough, they have all this power, but time has run out for them. And as I say, everybody in Washington right now is wondering how we're going to dump these people.
All right, now, we can dump these people, Eustace, but there is the dark looming terror of nuclear blackmail, of nuclear weapons.
Oh, there is that, yes.
And then the question I would ask you directly is, how far do you guess the most radical of Jewish leaders might go if they felt themselves really backed into a corner and about to be abandoned, according to your potential scenario, and faced with some real demotion in status, if not major crisis for survival? How far would they go, do you think?
Well, I don't think too far, because, you see, Masada was one of the great legends of the early Jewish people in the Middle East, and they committed suicide.
Right.
And Masada is still an important holiday among the Jewish people, but they realized that that didn't work, so they never tried that again. And I don't think these people are that suicidal. I think they might just have to bow out gracefully. I don't know.
Well, we have a problem now, which the people at Masada didn't, and that's war by proxy with weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, yes.
And that has been discussed on this program and others, I'm sure. If there is a, let's just say for the sake of discussion, a weapon of mass destruction or several of them ignited here in the country, if they're explosive with dirty nuclear material, or if it's a biological weapon, we will never know, Eustace, who really did it.
We won't. Because of the phrase called agent provocateur, and when an agent provocateur does something like that, you never can really trace it back to them.
Why isn't there, I mean, this is a rhetorical question, but I'll give you a shot at answering it for fun anyhow, and just for the folks who are trying to catch up with all this. Why haven't we been reading about this amazing Israeli spy ring in the media in this country? Now, I know the answer, and most of the people listening know it, but I want to just address the question as if we didn't know.
Well, it shows the control that they have, that they can keep it out of the media, and they have kept it out of the media. But the problem with suppressing something is it's sort of like a dam. You can hold the water back for a certain amount of time, and then it starts to leak. And once it leaks, it becomes a flood. And that's where we are right now. I think this whole thing is just about ready to break loose.
Will it break loose in a larger Mideastern war, do you think, in the next months or even weeks, some people suggest?
No, I don't see that, because the Arabs are not cooperating. You know, Bush said that he wanted to attack 34 Arab nations that were harboring terrorists. Well, that's all the Arab nations there are, you know, 34. He wanted to get them all. That was the promise. This is what the Israeli Fifth Column had persuaded him to do as a program. But he was premature. He should not have announced that he was going to do all 34. He should have used the domino theory, which originally was to be Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, and then finally Saudi Arabia and Kuwait. But he announced at the beginning he was going to do all 34, and of course the Arabs then decided they'd better cool this thing off a little bit.
His Bush's rhetoric in the beginning was, quite frankly, embarrassing. It reminded me of an out-of-control teenager. I'm not diminishing for a moment the tragedy of September 11th, but some of the statements made, which have long been forgotten, as you all will notice, were so excessive. The war will not end in our lifetimes, and
we're
on
still
and
sticking
on and on.
To that. Yes. In fact, Rumsfeld is still repeating the same thing. So is Colin Powell. It's like the Hundred Years' War of old Germany, you know, in Europe.
Right. Well, it's the same. It does seem rather similar to that's a good template to put on it. We do seem to be back, however, to the domino approach now. Iraq now being talked more and more about being a target. There are many projections in the media about a possible attack on them. I know the Iranians have to be more than concerned, because they're probably next.
And, they're supposed to be next. They're number two, right?
The top man in Iran unleashed a tremendously heated tirade against the United States today, calling the U.S. A bully nation, and so on and so forth. So I think these countries who are striving for certainly their right to be an independent country and arm themselves with whatever weapons they can get a hold of, it's called free enterprise in a way, are realizing that their days may be numbered. And you may see some interesting alliances very soon, such as Iran, Iraq, and others. We'll pause and come back after the top of the hour with Eustace Mullins, and we'll change gears a bit and talk about his book, Murder by Injection, and some other things as well. Maybe your calls, too, in the next hour as we continue. Okay, we are back. I'm Jeff Rentz, and my guest tonight for the first 2 hours, Eustace Mullins, who will be speaking at a remarkable event in Santa Rosa, California, May 25th and the 26th. It is a conspiracy conference, and the website to go to for all the details, conspiracycon.com, conspiracycon.com. You can click on Eustace's name and go right there as well from my homepage. We've had lots to talk about in the first hour, and we'll talk about more in the second hour. But before we switch to the medical aspect, there are a few more things we should talk about vis-a-vis the Middle East and the war in Iraq. America, this country that you fought in World War II to defend, and with hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of your countrymen and countrywomen fought, were wounded, and in many cases died, has involved itself in a genocide, not just one, but the one I'm going to talk about for a moment or two here is that which we have presided upon in the country of Iraq. As you well know, over the past 10, 11 years, we have, through our embargo, literally put to death over 1 million people, the majority of which were children and young people, and they certainly were all non-combatants in the traditional sense of the word. How is it that something like this, Eustace, can actually occur in a world that is supposed to be evolving? It clearly isn't evolving, and I'm very concerned about its very future. How do you feel about that?
Well, you know, the Gulf War, which we thought would depose Saddam Hussein, and the elder President Bush called him the new Hitler, and actually it kept him in power, just like Bay of Pigs and the CIA kept Castro in power in Cuba when he was due to collapse. So we actually go in and save these people, these dictators that we want to keep. And, of course, that's very hard on the people who live there. It's been very hard on the people of Cuba, and it's been very hard on the people in Iraq. But Saddam Hussein is the beneficiary of all this. He's not a victim.
Well, he was our golden boy in the 1980s, of course, in the war against Iran. And we know now that we have supplied him with weapons of mass destruction, equipment, and materiel, both before and after the Gulf War. And yet this genocide continues. Over 1 million people have been sacrificed. I don't think that this country has a much darker moment to consider in the last half century than the intentional slaughter of 1 million people.
Well, it's almost been totally suppressed in this country. It's very rarely mentioned, you know.
It's not mentioned essentially at all.
Yes.
If we invade Iraq and Saddam Hussein uses, or maybe he doesn't use them, but if weapons of mass destruction, let's say a vial of a deadly pathogen is used against the invading armies of Britain and America, the word from Washington is that we will use nuclear weapons in retaliation.
Oh, yes.
Now, this is clearly a setup from the word go. I mean, we're not going to know who used what weapon, when, or where. We just can't know it. So it seems that the threat of nuclear weapons is profound. It's immediate. And would it surprise you if they're used?
No, because this is not war games. Whatever they have decided to do, they've already decided to do it. And I don't know what anybody could do about it.
Rather like the Afghanistan situation, when we have ample evidence that the invasion plans and the idea of removing the Taliban were certainly in concrete months and months before the attacks of September 11th.
Yes.
Because the Taliban wouldn't play ball with the oil companies. For one reason or another.
And the dope traffic apparently had something to do with it also.
Well, the Taliban reduced it by 90% or thereabout, and you don't want to do that with opium. Now, of course, to no one's surprise, the opium crop is said to be back up to near record or at record, all-time record levels this year, just a few months after the eviction of the Taliban.
Yes. So that shows what they were really fighting for.
Sounds like Vietnam.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, Roosevelt started the Vietnam War because Ho Chi Minh was his top agent in Southeast Asia. And, of course, his the Delano fortune came from his grandfather, Warren Delano, who in the Hong Kong opium trade.
So another Osama bin Laden, another Saddam Hussein, is Ho Chi Minh. One of our boys who we turned out.
Well, you know, Roosevelt insisted that Ho Chi Minh's reports from Southeast Asia be placed on his desk every day when they came in. That was the top priority. He's fighting a war against Hitler and the fascists, but the top priority was Ho Chi Minh.
Because of the drugs. Amazing.
Because of the drugs. These people always know what they're doing, but they don't like to tell other people what they're doing. They don't want other people to find out what they're doing.
Drugs and money.
Drugs and money. Oh, yes.
The largest military base since the Vietnam War, American military base, is nearing completion now in Yugoslavia, Bosnia, somewhere over there. I've got the story up there. I've forgotten the exact location. But quite clearly, this base is being installed for a number of reasons having to do with oil and drugs. And, the last great breadbasket of oil and drugs seems to be the Caspian, that whole Central Asia plateau.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Okay, murder by injection. Let's bring it home and talk about this idea of injecting polluted substances, deadly substances, into the bodies of our young people and our older people as well. They're called vaccinations. Tell us how you view it today. It's not getting any better, and there are over 200 new vaccines in the pipeline now under development that will be either mandatory or recommended for our children.
Well, you know, Clinton's top advisor was Lloyd Cutler, who happened to be the lobbyist for the American Pharmaceutical Association. And he depended on Cutler for everything. Cutler chose his first attorney general, by the way. I forget her name now, but she lost out because of having illegal people in her home.
Oh, she hired a Mexican national or an illegal immigrant to work in her home.
Yeah, well, this girl was Lloyd Cutler's personal choice for attorney general. And he's the kind of a man who could tell the president who he wanted for attorney general, and he would obey. He not only was the lobbyist for the pharmaceutical companies, but also for the automobile companies.
All right, how much money in round numbers do we make every year by injecting Americans with often lethal doses of DNA, of viral fragments, and other terrible toxins?
Well, it's the biggest moneymaker in the whole pharmaceutical industry because, you see, you have a captive population. Most of them are children, and the parents believe that they're helping their children by agreeing to this.
And it's all done, again, by fear.
By fear, yes.
Don't vaccinate your kid, the kid's going to die. That's the implied message.
Well, it is. You know, when my book, Murder by Injection, came out, there was a lawyer in Jacksonville, Florida, who went on had a talk show every day, and he went on his radio program denouncing me and saying I was murdering children by circulating this book. He said,
well,
you have to spell as hard as children.
Yeah, I've heard that ludicrous argument before, and it's amazing when people just do a little bit of research how the truth comes roaring into their faces.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
It's frightful. So in the book, Murder by Injection, some of the key kind, this book is available in many locations. It sells all the time. Anything you want to mention for the book in specific, Eustace, for people out there who are struggling with this right now, who get that notice from the school district saying your child must be vaccinated or he or she cannot attend?
Well, they ought to know who it's coming from. It's coming from John D. Rockefeller. Rockefeller first got control of the money system by getting the Federal Reserve Act through. Do you know that Senator Aldrich, who chaired the Jekyll Island meeting where they wrote the original Federal Reserve Act in 1910, was the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller, Jr.? So they got control of the money system. And then the very next thing that Rockefeller did, he got control of the medical industry, because he realized how profitable that was. And so these guys always go out for the main chance.
The war on cancer has, I am told, raised and been given over $1 trillion.
Yes.
It has been an abject failure, of course.
No results of any kind. The death rate from cancer, I think, is exactly the same as it was 50 years ago.
There is no money in finding a cure for cancer. Keep that in mind, you folks and dear listeners who are dealing with that issue. Same treatments, disfiguring surgery, radiation, deadly poisons given in smaller amounts called chemotherapy. Remember our programs with Dr. Lorraine Day and others, and think about all this. Be right back with Eustace Mullins in a couple minutes. 800-876-4123. If you might like to call, I'm getting a lot of emails, so we'll open the phones and see if you have a question. 800-876-4123. Back with Eustace Mullins. Eustace, how do we... Boy, this is a toughie, because I personally don't see any way to do it, but maybe you've got a better insight than I, and I would think after all of your service to this country in terms of bringing information forward, you certainly must. How do we break the hold, which is now cradle to grave and includes the literal programming and mind control, the brainwashing of generation? We're into our second generation plus of total mind control, which is brought about, of course, through television, the popular culture, and the mass media. How do you break that? Again, I go back to what I said. How do we wake people up who are just not there?
Well, there is a reaction going on. Now, the health movement in this country is one of the healthiest things that I see going on, because as people get a better diet and stay away from fluoridated water and so forth, and the mercury fillings in the teeth, they begin to recover their health and they begin to think more logically. They're no longer drugged to the point of insensibility. So there's a lot going on right now.
There is an educational tool, the likes of which the world has not seen, at least this time around.
Yes.
It's called the Internet.
Oh, yes. The greatest thing ever happened.
It has to... I have a theory on what they are trying to do. They realized, I think, several years ago, maybe even longer, that they couldn't control it. There's no way they can control it. So what they're, I think, doing, Eustace, and maybe you can correct me if I'm way off base on this, but they are flooding the net with operatives, with assets, who are continuing to create as much noise and diffusion as they possibly can to keep people off focus. It's not working, but it is confusing.
Oh, it is confusing, and you're right. That's the only tactic they have. The first weapon they used against the Internet was child pornography, and they actually got Congress to pass a law against it. But the Supreme Court threw it out, and so that didn't work, so they have to try other things.
So you can trace that back, in your view, to an intentional effort to just trash the Internet by flooding it with smut.
Oh, absolutely, because that's a... That way they could discredit the information that the Internet was holding, you know.
a vast cesspool of porn, of violence, of crime. Why haven't we seen, and the answer is obvious, and many people say, well, how do you get porn off the net? You create a second internet entirely for porn. Pornography is the number one website destination on the internet, so you simply have Internet 1, Internet 2, and you keep all porn off 2 or whatever. That's the answer, but it's not going to happen because of the intent with which pornography is being infused into the entire system.
Yes, because before the internet, pornography was a separate operation of its own. Movies, books, everything, pornography, that was simply a business.
Right.
And it had nothing to do with anything else. So what they did, they interjected the internet with pornography to try to mess up the whole thing, but it just didn't work.
There's still a lot of talk about terror attacks here, not a question of if, but a question of when. And when that talk comes from the higher officials in the elected government in Washington, I think you and I and many of our listeners realize that they, in many cases, know a little bit more than they're talking about. The foreknowledge indications of the September 11th attacks are at this point, more than formidable. Your views?
Oh, there's no question about that. And what I'm afraid of is that as they keep talking about terror attacks, in order to keep up the war on terrorism, they're absolutely obligated to have another terror attack in the United States to keep
obligated.
This
going. Obligated.
They're obligated, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
If you've got a program, you cannot watch your program collapse in front of your eyes. You got to do something to keep it going.
Was not, in your view, and it is mine, that the Oklahoma City bombing was a prelude to this, perhaps a, not a dress rehearsal, but an initial trial balloon to see how it would work, to measure it, to study it, and all the rest of it?
Oh, absolutely. That's why they picked Oklahoma City. They weren't going to blow up a government building in Washington because they don't blow up their own office, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Oklahoma City was perfect. It was far enough away that there was no way they would have any damage. And, of course, they had most of the people stay home that day, too, the ATF and those the FBI.
The latest on the anthrax continues to be, it was an American biological. And there are two or three people who are being mentioned as having complicity in the potential spread of it. But it clearly was not an Arab issue. It was a domestic issue.
Well, I wrote an article about that called Anthrax is an American as Apple Pie.
Mm-hmm.
That came out in October.
Mm-hmm.
And I traced the whole thing back to James Conant, president of Harvard, a chemist, who was hired by Winston Churchill to develop the anthrax bomb so that they could exterminate everybody in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got that article out, the noise about anthrax dropped about 90%.
It was a very safe and a very, I think, manageable kind of thing to do. We did lose five or six people, sad to say, but a very self-limiting kind of a biological weapon. If it were released by terrorists, there certainly would have been a follow-up and so on and so forth. We have to keep that in mind. September 11th happened, and that was it, at least in terms of the alleged perpetrators, the Arabs. And then we had the anthrax issue, which, as you just said, is an American homegrown. So what do we really have here? Do we have any evidence of international terrorism? What do you think?
No, I don't see any. In fact, I said after September 11th, I told people in law enforcement, I said, you don't have to worry about security. There's not going to be any follow-up in the foreseeable future. And I was absolutely right, because here we are 9 months later, and nothing has happened. But as I say, eventually they're going to have to do something. When
right.
I say they, I mean the people behind the scenes are going to have to make a move and blow up something else. But there's no question.
Yeah. As Americans slip back into their complacency, their comfort zone, they don't like that, because the fear factor is the key fuel that drives the engine of oppression here. Be right back in just a minute with Eustace Mullins. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're along, and I hope you're enjoying it. Okay, we're back, and a conversation with Eustace Mullins tonight. He'll be appearing in Santa Clara with a who's who of conspiracy authors and researchers. ConspiracyCon, CON.com is the website, May 25th and 26th. If you want to call now for ticket information, 209-832-0999. The state of the presidency, obviously it's more of a system of marionettes than anything else, at least the top people. What has happened to this country since the murder of John Kennedy? Was that the last gasp of even the semblance of a free and independent executive branch?
Yes, and the murder of JFK Jr. was right up the same alley. You know, JFK Jr. was about to launch a major expose of Mossad in his magazine, George, and that's why his plane went down.
I've heard that. That whole thing was, I think, a real tragedy for the American people.
It really was, because he was the white hope. I don't know how bright he was. But he certainly had the name.
He did, and he was, and you're right. And I think the rapidity with which the American public was force-fed that that cover-up was despicable, frankly.
It really was. I mean, these stories that I read in the paper immediately about how he lost his sense of direction and became confused.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these people must have been right in the cockpit with him to have written those stories.
Yeah, his flight instructor has never surfaced in the media. That guy disappeared.
Oh, boy.
I've heard or seen one word. He allegedly went on vacation or went to Europe or something. Who knows? But that plane, you have to think about common sense. His plane was left at Teterboro Airport unattended, Eustace, and too easy for anybody to go up there and stick a cigarette package-sized explosive in the baggage compartment in the rear of that plane and just, whenever, altimeter sensitive, whatever, blew the tail off the plane.
Oh, I did that because I vacation in Martha's Vineyard every year, and a friend of mine that lives up there that I stay with, he sent me an article from the Vineyard Gazette, which is one of the two newspapers on Martha's Vineyard, in which a lawyer in a rowboat saw the plane explode, and the Vineyard Gazette printed his story.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was the most important news story of the year. No other newspaper ever printed that story. Not one.
I wonder what happened to the lawyer.
Well, I haven't heard any more about him.
He probably got a phone call or a visit real quick.
I think so.
Wow, I hadn't heard that. When I heard of the people on the beach seeing the flash, I've heard a couple of people hearing the blast.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, well, clearly. Was he about to announce for the New York senatorial seat, or was he being considered for the vice presidential nomination?
Oh, I haven't heard of any vice president. I think he was coming out for president.
He was going straight for it.
Well, I think that's why he waited all the time. That's mm-hmm. why he never piddled around with any party politics or anything like that, because when he came in, he would come in at the top. After all, he lived in the White House.
which you own.
Oh, yes.
Don't forget that.
Yes.
I think without any question in my mind, he could have and would have succeeded had it been a reasonable and fair set of circumstances.
Oh, yes. Well, he was a nice-looking guy, and I think he would have been all right.
Well, considering what we have now, and what do we have now? Just a puppet, just a marionette, yes?
Well, they're actually the dregs, unfortunately. The dregs of the nation. That's the only way I can describe mm-hmm. them.
As far as the Congress and the Senate in general go, I've talked about it for years on this program. My dad said something to me a long time ago. He said, anyone who seeks higher public office ought to be barred from it. The motivations are wrong. And by the time they get there, they are corrupted and bought and sold so many times, they're worthless anyhow. But something happens to these people by the time they get to Washington, almost invariably. There are a few exceptions. Congressman Ron Paul certainly comes to mind immediately.
He's the only congressman I know today is Ron Paul. I used to know, four or five congressmen, a couple of senators 30 or 40 years ago, but no more.
Is it just a question of money? They get co-opted?
It's money.
Is it bribery?
Well, it's money and power, and also media attention. I mean, you don't get on the major television talk shows unless you're singing their song.
It has also been mentioned by people. Sherman Skolnick has made mention of this several times, that the level of blackmail and coercion in the nation's capital has probably never been higher than it is right now.
Oh, that's right. I've done talk shows with Sherman, and he does great work. I'm amazed the guy's still alive. Of course, he's in a wheelchair, and I guess they just haven't done anything with him.
He's a frequent guest on the program, and in fact, will be coming up after this segment tonight.
So, oh, good.
Yeah. Okay, we've covered a lot of ground. Many of your works are available, and I want to kind of just turn it over to you, and what would you like to talk about for our remaining time here on this hour?
Well, I hit the highlights about the fact that everybody in Washington is trying to figure out a way to dump Israel right now. That is the number one program. And second, the people behind the scenes have got to perpetrate some new atrocity in this country in order to keep their program going. I mean, everybody is fed up with the war on terrorism. And the only way they can renew it is with a good spark. And
well, we haven't caught many terrorists, have we? We've got a few people in jail in Guantanamo. We killed 5,000 or 6,000 Afghan civilians en route to maybe who knows how many hundreds or a thousand or two of various Taliban and al-Qaeda fighters and others, a tribal war. But what have we really to show for it beside a new pipeline negotiation?
Well, there was a headline on TV tonight, is the war on terror losing its focus? Well, they never had any
focus
to begin with. Yeah, there was no focus.
And is it true that Osama is vacationing at the ranch in Crawford, Texas?
Well, that's really the best place for him, frankly, if he wants to be safe.
And Mullah Omar, remember him, folks? Whatever happened to him? All right, you notice that U.S. troops are now engaged in Afghanistan and in Pakistan on the ground, allegedly chasing al-Qaeda fighters in Pakistan. Musharraf's victory today, he claims 97.5% of a remarkably high turnout at the polls. Of course, the cries of fraud and foul are running louder than his cries of victory right now in Pakistan, a much troubled country. We'll be right back with Eustace Mullins in just a minute. Back with Eustace Mullins. I should take a moment here to thank a lot of our Jewish listeners and site visitors who have sent emails thanking us for the effort to cover the issue from their perspective, which is one of non-support of the current administration in Israel. And we've tried to cover both sides. We'll be putting stories up as we continue to get them. But generally speaking, the reaction in the world's press has been about 90% against what has been going on in the Middle East, and we report that as we get it. We'll continue to watch it as we were. You know, this whole September 11th tragedy, Eustace, there are, I posted a list of, I forget how many questions, 500 questions or something, at the website. You've probably seen that list as well. There's some outstanding questions in there. But one of the interesting little parts of this story, which has not received much attention, and I believe was only mentioned for the first day or two, had to do with the reported threat that the Secret Service received at the White House the morning of the attacks, which made it quite clear that somebody somewhere had access to the ultra top secret information and telephone numbers accessing the data for our nuclear weapons arsenal. The codes, the daily codes, which are changed every day, were given over the phone in a threatening phone call to the Secret Service. That part of the story has gotten scant coverage, one of the biggest parts of it, in my opinion, of all.
Oh, it certainly is. That's extreme. The American people should know that.
But they don't.
No, they don't.
That's probably why Bush was hustled to the nuclear bunker. Cheney was put in cold storage, safe storage, because that call had to shake up the chain of command from the top to the bottom.
Well, it did, but you know, there was a precedent for that. You remember that the elder President Bush, when the Israelis demanded an extra $10 billion from him while he was president.
Oh, yeah.
And he refused, and they called, and he was denounced in the Knesset in Tel Aviv as the new Hitler. And so,
Really?
Oh, yeah. So the Israelis are not happy about the Bush family at all. And I was told that a rogue element in Mossad actually did intend to take out Bush during this September 11th operation. That's why he went on a lamb.
A decapitation.
Oh, yes.
Well, it's not over yet. And,
no, it's not.
He's sitting on that 20-year White House jinx, too, which...
Oh, he is. You know, I saw him on TV the other night, and he looked older than his father. I was shocked. And I think that a couple of days since, they put on some makeup. But he actually looked horrible there one day when I saw him, about 3 days ago.
I wouldn't want to be there now.
He is on the hot seat, there's no question about it.
I hate to say it, but yeah, hot seat. I would go a step further and suggest that to many people he is expendable. And
he's always been expendable.
Totally expendable, and it might serve the purpose of really driving the fear factor home to the core in the American media-controlled monopoly here.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, the fact that Cheney is his vice president, who would then replace him...
Instantly, and what do we got?
...was on Halliburton. And you know who was running Halliburton? Was Lord Clitheroe of London. And Lord Clitheroe was the chief Rothschild agent. Clitheroe was the chairman of RTZ Zinc for 24 years, which is the principal Rothschild company, Rio Tinto Zinc.
Wow.
So you see, Halliburton was run by Lord Clitheroe, and Cheney was his man. And so if Cheney became president, Lord Clitheroe and the Rothschilds would have a total control over him.
You know, though, even a cursory examination of the September 11th attacks with the alleged terrorist hijackers the night before out in public making an ostentatious spectacle of themselves.
Oh, yes.
Leaving debris around in suitcases and this passport.
Our diaries and everything else.
Oh, come on. I mean, it's really what it is. It's third-rate Hollywood screenplay fiction.
It is indeed, yes. It's what the old Republic company, the Great B movies, used to do.
Sure. John Wayne would have been in it somewhere.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, Republic used to grind them out.
Oh, it did.
Okay, we have September 11th in the books. I hate to put you on the spot here, but would it surprise you if there was a major tragedy in the White House at some point in the near future?
I think it's almost inevitable. I'm not being pessimistic, but right. I feel like that they've got to make a move very soon to get to keep control of the situation.
Dirty nuclear weapons?
Oh, that could be it. I think they're a little hesitant about that because the results are too uncontrollable.
The real giveaway, was it not, Eustace, the complete lack of follow-up terror attacks? Wasn't that...
Absolutely. And I knew that there would be none. I just knew it. So I told people that. I told them very frankly. I said, don't be worried. Everything is over for the time being.
The corporate state of health in America is so bad right now.
Oh,
and
it
yet
is.
There is this silly optimism that the fakirs keep pumping up, saying that the economy is in good shape. America is in dire straits. The corporate profits reports are apparently as dismal as they've ever been. The leading telecoms are all in great trouble to one degree or another, borrowing billions and billions of dollars just to meet cash flow and expenses, not capital improvements. People talk about a crash. They have forever since 29. They've talked about another crash. I don't think we'll see a total crash here, but would you expect to see some kind of a major economic seizure soon?
Oh, I certainly would. You know, for 30 years, whenever I gave a lecture, the first the first question was always asked at question and answer periods, when is the crash coming? Because that's what people expect. But right now, there is not going to be a crash, but the recovery is not going to happen either. So we're sort of in limbo right now. Mm-hmm.
What about the concept of factions within the government, fighting for power, vying against each other?
I've always doubted those stories. I don't believe a word of it, frankly. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any factions in the government fighting about anything. I think that the agenda is pretty well known, and the people go along with it.
All right. I want to wind up with what I started earlier. I wanted to get back to this, and that has to do with Hollywood and its control over the American mind, the American imagination, the American psyche with its films. Is this the foremost weapon, perhaps, of the degradation of our once reasonably robust social fabric here?
Oh, yes, and it has a very distinguished history. You know, Plato wrote about it in his Republic, about the shadows on the wall of the caves, and that's what we've got.
The shadows on the wall of the caves.
Yeah, Plato wrote it. The big Greeks knew all of this was going on. That's what we've got.
Well, I've mentioned that the Chinese, of course, realized that they had to get their TVs in place in every home in China by the end of the year 2000, and I believe they made it. That was their big goal.
Well, they probably did make it. No, that's where your control is.
Sure. We can talk a little bit about China and Taiwan in our remaining couple of minutes. There is yet another warning as more and more missiles are being moved in place just across the Straits of Taiwan, facing Taiwan. Chinese Vice President Hu warned again today that differences over Taiwan could hurt U.S.-Chinese relations, and he vigorously defended his country's human rights record on and on. But the Taiwan question remains a big one. Do you see a move on Taiwan, and how much of a ruckus would we put up to defend Taiwan?
Well, we wouldn't do much of anything because the military-industrial complex would like to see that because it would certainly be good for their business.
Good for business.
Yeah, I don't see any positive results one way or the other. I really don't know that the Chinese would want to take out Taiwan because it remains a very wonderful bone of contention.
Well, it is that. But to swallow it up as another Hong Kong would certainly be agreeable to them.
Well, they'd like to do that, but it's in the long range, I would say. They're having their troubles with Hong Kong anyway, because it's not that easy to run as they thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, as you look into the next 6 months, let me ask you to forecast. What do you see happening?
Well, the next 6 months, I don't see much happening, frankly. I think we're going to stagger along till the end of the year at about the same mythical recovery that we've got right now, and I don't see any big military operations. I really do not believe we're going to attack Iraq. I never have thought so.
Huh.
The only people who are arguing for it are the Israeli lobby, Richard Perle and Ken Edelman and those people.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me ask you in our last minute and a half to analyze very quickly Israel and Pakistan, which has the Muslim bomb.
Yes. Well, that would be a Mexican standoff, I would say. I don't think either one of them would want to use it.
Mm-hmm. With Musharraf holding his bogus referendum, claiming 98% majority in favor of him, I think we can see the corruption there. How in bed with us is Musharraf? Is he our man there?
I don't think he's our man, but I think we intend to work with him. We've used Pakistan as the sounding board for the whole Afghanistan operation,
mm-hmm.
which, and as you and I both agree, the Afghanistan operation is about one of the phoniest things we've ever done in our lives.
Pathetic. The latest antics are to threaten the warlords now that if they don't play ball with us, they are going to become the next terrorist targets in their own country. So I see no easy resolution over there.
Not at all, no. There again, it's a stalemate. I see stalemate all the rest of this year, and I don't see anything big happening, but hope I'm right.
I'd vote for that, too. Eustace Mullins, thank you for a delightful and informative and memorable 2 hours. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to be on your show.
All right. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
All right.
Eustace Mullins, who will be appearing May 25th, 26th at the Conspiracy Conference in Santa Clara, California. ConspiracyCon.com is the website. We'll pause and be back.